It's Thursday, October 29th. Donald Trump can't possibly win, can he? Now, where have I heard that before? We start here. The overall picture might be looking more and more out of reach, but key states are still deceptively close.
Is he going to win, though, Florida when he loses Pennsylvania? That seems a little bit unlikely.
Nate Silver from 538 is here to break down what it would take for another surprise Trump victory. Tech executives have spent 4 years analyzing their mistakes, but had they overcorrected?
Are these speech machines or are they amplification machines?
Why senators are all a Twitter, and amid concerns about how seriously we're taking this pandemic.
I would like to say the same for the United States, but the numbers speak for themselves.
Some scientists are already on the lookout for another one. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. Remember when I told you 1 million ballots were arriving around America every day? I was cute.
Tonight, the early voting tsunami continues.
At this point, the rate is more than 5 million ballots pouring into elections offices every day, making at least 75 million votes cast so far.
Well, we just voted.
Early on in the pandemic, we thought about half the electorate could vote early. Well, if you look at the 2016 numbers, this would mean 54% of the country has already voted. Now, we are expecting an even higher turnout this year, but that also means President Trump would need even bigger numbers than he posted 4 years ago. So I want to start the day by looking at the polls and asking a simple question: what would a Trump re-election look like? We got the editor-in-chief of 538 himself, our friend Nate Silver, with us. Nate, at this point, you got Joe Biden with an 88 out of 100 chance of winning the presidency. So besides time running out, what are the most important factors here? What shifted for him?
I mean, a lot of it is the time running out. It's actually been a pretty steady race for a couple of months now. Biden seemed to gain ground after the first debate a little bit. Maybe it tightened a little bit kind of before the final debate. It's not clear that Trump's actually improved since the final debate.
We have a couple new polls out today from the battleground states, including Michigan, shows Joe Biden a solid lead right there, about 7 points. That's about where it's been.
Particularly in states where you saw the biggest shift from Obama to Trump. Is exactly the state where Biden has made the biggest rebound.
Cases in Wisconsin are surging, and the U.S. is now on track to double our death rate within the next few months.
Wisconsin, Michigan, Minnesota. He won Minnesota, Clinton did, but not by much, right? Maine is a state that Clinton just barely won. New Hampshire just barely won, and Biden is way ahead in polls there, right?
So if you look at the 2016 map, you would see the states that Hillary Clinton lost, but that wouldn't even tell you the whole story of how many of these types of voters Trump was able to flip.
Right. And it's kind of concentrated in like the just the north. You know, there are a lot of like working class white people in the north of the country. Right?
Right.
In the south, it's more of a story about turnout and demographics and new voters potentially. Or it might be more a story of upscale suburbs flipping to Biden in Georgia, for example. You know, we're so used to thinking of Florida as purple and Georgia as red. But in our polling average, as we're talking right now, Biden's ahead by 1.4 points, not a big lead, obviously, within the margin of error, but the same margin in both Georgia and Florida. So there's no longer a divide between them, apparently.
Right. I mean, some people have even started to wonder whether it's more likely that Biden wins Georgia than winning Florida or even like North Carolina. Like, this is not your mom and dad's map, is what they've essentially been saying.
Yeah. In some ways, kind of the states you don't see coming. You know, Obama won Virginia by a wide margin that year, right? In Colorado. And so, you know, one of the funny things about this campaign is that the Trump campaign, for all the talk we heard early in the year, is running out of money. And so Biden gets to play in a couple of extra states like Georgia, like Arizona. I mean, Arizona, everyone knew was going to be a battleground state. But, you know, Georgia and Iowa are states where if Biden gets to play in 12 states and Trump gets to play in 6 because Biden has more money, then all of a sudden, you know, these problems pop up for Trump that that just make his life more annoying in some ways.
Well, so let's talk about the flip side of that then, because if there are, you know, 100 raffle tickets in this thing and Joe Biden's got 88 of them, that means there's still 12, and that's not nothing. But I don't want to just hear about like statistical averages. I want to hear state by state. How would President Trump actually pull this off? What would be his path right now?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's one precise scenario.
We're going to win in Pennsylvania, I think.
Which is Trump wins Pennsylvania, where Biden is only 5 points ahead. So you overcome a 5-point deficit there, and then everything that's more conservative in Pennsylvania, you hold on to.
Midwest, the little areas in the Midwest, certain areas that are
heated up right now. They'll go down. They'll go down very quickly.
Let's say we buy that there's something, whether it's coronavirus in Wisconsin and Michigan or whatever else, right? Let's buy that Biden holds those, right? Is he going to win, though, Florida when he loses Pennsylvania? That seems a little bit unlikely. You know, is he going to win North Carolina, which has kind of similar demographics in some ways? Maybe a little bit unlikely.
By the way, we are substantially up in a state known as Arizona. Do you know about that, right?
I think the Achilles heel for Trump, though, is Arizona in that configuration, because Arizona is a very different type of state, right? It also has a lot of early voting. Every state has a lot of early voting this year, right? But that vote in Arizona might be pretty locked in. So Arizona is a place where Trump could have trouble, even if he wins Pennsylvania. And Biden does have winning maps that involve Arizona instead of Pennsylvania.
But it sounds like you're basically saying, like, if Trump doesn't win Pennsylvania, ball game for most of these scenarios.
Without Pennsylvania, then, you know, it's pretty hard to imagine. I mean, Trump is an underdog, and you have a 12% chance. That doesn't mean it's zero, right? But it does mean that you can't afford to lose any of the close calls, right? You have to execute on, it's like when the Patriots came back to beat the Falcons, right? In Super Bowl, whichever it was, 28-3, you know, their chance wasn't zero. But they had to execute on basically every play perfectly.
Oh, like, right? Any of those plays goes wrong, goodbye, game over, see you later.
Right. And Trump's not quite in those dire straits. I mean, I think the Falcons were at 99%, which is way different than 80-something, right? But, like, he needs almost everything to go right.
Yeah, and like you said, so important to remember, I mean, there were big rises and falls in the polls in 2016. Like, big news events really shaped things. Here, you've had debates, almost no movement. You had COVID relief and COVID deaths. Almost no movement. Now you've had a Supreme Court justice confirmed, huge moment for the presidency, but still no movement. We'll see if anything can change what is baked in over the next, 5 days. Nate Silver, thanks so much.
Great. Thank you.
We've convened this morning to continue the work of this committee to ensure that the internet remains a free and open space.
You might think with 5 days to go in their reelection campaigns, a lot of senators really don't want to be in Washington right now either. You'd be right. And yet yesterday, you did have a handful of senators in person and several sitting in remotely on the biggest hearing of the day, a summit of some of the biggest names in tech, Mark Zuckerberg from Facebook, Sundar Pichai from Google, and Jack Dorsey from Twitter. But the reason senators took the time to attend this was not just to look at Dorsey's impossibly long beard. It was because this time of year, these companies can have a bigger impact than TV ads, than yard signs, even rallies. Experts say these companies can shape elections now and perhaps for years to come. Let's go to an expert here. Joan Donovan is a research director at the Shorenstein Center on Media, Politics, and Public Policy at Harvard, where she studies the impact of tech. I can imagine a million things for senators to do right now besides talk about, what was this, Section 230, right? Most of us have never heard of it. Why was this the thing to argue about this week?
Yeah, so it basically is what's famed as the 26 words that created the internet. And what it does is it does two things, and Zuckerberg pointed them both out. It releases the company from liability for what people say on their platforms.
It encourages free expression, which is fundamentally important.
Think about if we were to hold AT&T or Sprint responsible for any time someone like places a bet over the phone lines, right? That's illegal activity, but we allow those companies not to be held liable for that. The second thing it does, though, and this is probably the most poorly understood part by Congress of their own policy, is it incentivizes certain kinds of content moderation if it's done in the public interest.
Without 230, platforms could face liability for basic moderation, like removing harassment that impacts the safety of their communities.
And this is why we don't see, you know, hundreds and hundreds of naughty pictures on our platforms, is because platforms do a lot of work to get rid of things like pornography and spam, which it would be riddled with without the capacity to moderate.
You are not the referees of our political speech. That's why all three of you have to be more transparent and fair with your content moderation policies and your content selection algorithms, because at the moment it is, as I said, largely a black box.
Well, and so there's throughout this hearing, then, you heard, especially Republicans, I thought, Ted Cruz in particular, seemed just profoundly frustrated with some of these tech CEOs, especially Jack Dorsey from Twitter.
Mr. Dorsey, who the hell elected you and put you in charge of what the media are allowed to report and what the American people are allowed to hear.
For what he described as is basically censorship. I mean, are those legitimate concerns at this time?
Well, depending upon what you think content moderation should do, nobody's really disputing that medical misinformation needs to be dealt with because there are serious health concerns and people's behaviors do change.
This morning, Facebook vowing to fight back against anti-vaccination propaganda across its platforms.
Anytime that we see misinformation, hoaxes, inaccurate information about vaccines being shared in a group or a page, we will be taking action.
But with political disinformation, it hits different because some of these politicians greatly benefit from the openness of our information environment.
Twitter is flagging another post from President Trump as misleading after he claimed there were, quote, problems and discrepancies with mail-in ballots all over the USA. Must have final total on November 3rd.
They want to distract us from WikiLeaks. It's been amazing what's coming out on WikiLeaks.
One of the things that these companies do have policies on, and their more recent policies, are about hack and leak operations, right? We know what happened in 2016 with the WikiLeaks, emails, and how that really hit the DNC hard and required people to step down. But then over time, as people interrogated the sourcing of those leaks, they realized, oh, this came from Russian intelligence. And so policy at these corporations emanated from that, where they said, well, we're not going to be the distribution system for hack and leak operations.
We have a policy against misinformation in three categories, which are manipulated media, public health, specifically COVID, and civic integrity, election interference, and voter suppression.
And that gets to the heart of this question of censorship, which is, are these speech machines or are they amplification machines or are they both?
Just to be clear, we have not censored the president. We have not taken the tweets down that you're referencing. They have more context than a label applied to them. And we do the same for leaders around the world.
And, you know, what kind of policy we get from that is really going to matter for the future of the internet.
Well, and so let's talk about the future, because it's interesting to me that like when one party loses, they're suddenly very against big tech. Then the other party's in trouble and they're like, well, now we're the ones being marginalized by big tech. So like opportunistic, maybe. But it also makes me wonder if these are bipartisan problems. And then the question is, like, what are we going to do as we move towards Election Day and beyond?
Well, no group benefits more than politicians in this moment or people that have politically motivated ideological ends, because the cost of doing messaging is so low that you can reach millions and millions of people without a huge budget. And the way that social media advertising is designed is non-transparent. So I could literally target everybody around you, and you would never see it.
The still crowded field, perhaps leaving the door open for billionaire Michael Bloomberg.
Like, nobody really believed that the Instagrammers that were, supporting Bloomberg really were going to vote for Bloomberg, right?
And even dropping sponsored memes, branding himself as the cool candidate. Tongue-in-cheek marketing targeting younger, social media savvy voters.
But they were getting paid to pretend as if they were big fans. And that, to me, when I know something's possible and I've seen a millionaire or a billionaire pull it off, then I worry, okay, well, what is the smaller scale version of this that is probably already existing and running rampant across the platforms?
Democrats often say that we don't remove enough content, and Republicans often say we remove too much. I expect that we'll hear some of those criticisms today. And the fact that both sides criticize us doesn't mean that we're getting this right, but it does mean that there are real disagreements about where the limits of online speech should be.
One thing that's kind of interesting about those tech hearings, though, that I think people need to pay more attention to is the way that these CEOs are called to give testimony. Their capability at giving an answer but not actually stating the substance.
Well, most of the content on the systems is not political. It's things like making sure that you can see when your you know, your cousin had her baby, or...
Okay.
And I think that really came through in Amy Klobuchar's questioning.
That's not what I'm talking about, the cousins and the babies here. I'm talking about conspiracy theories and all the things that I think us, the senators on both sides of the aisle, know what I'm talking about. And I think it's been corrosive.
What's at stake is the integrity of all of the other industries that have to deal with misinformation at scale, like journalism, like law enforcement, like civil society, and like our public health professionals. And so we need to get on this now.
Yeah, that's the big thing, right? You talk about the concept of free speech, everyone's behind it. Then you start talking about the ramifications for if information is allowed to be disseminated that is untrue or harmful, what do you do then? Joan Donovan from Harvard, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Next up on Start Here, if you thought this spring was as bad as it could possibly get, some disease researchers say you're not using your imagination. Back after the break.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
The first ever criminal trial of a former president is underway in Manhattan. It's one of potentially four trials facing former President Trump as he makes his third bid for the White House. What do voters think about his culpability, and would a guilty verdict make a difference in the election? I'm Galen Druk, and every Monday and Thursday on the 538 Politics podcast, we break down the latest news from the campaign trail. We sort through the noise and zoom in on what really matters, using data and research as we go. That's 538 Politics every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Dr. Fauci, it's not very polite to ask a guest to comment on yourself. It puts them in a difficult spot, but you're used to difficult spots. So when you look around the world, how do you think Australia's done?
Australia is one of the countries that has done actually quite well, I believe.
Well, you're a wonderful guest. Thank you.
Yesterday, Dr. Anthony Fauci spoke to some interviewers in Australia as their second largest city, Melbourne, ended a lockdown after 111 days. And this was not a, you know, restaurants can only be open outdoors lockdown. This was businesses are closed and you cannot travel more than 20 miles from your house.
If you look, I mean, I would like to say the same for the United States, but the numbers speak for themselves.
And Fauci said something head-turning in this interview. He said, because of how out of control the virus has become here in America,
I think it will be easily by the end of 2021 and perhaps even into the next year before we start having some semblances of normality. And it really depends on what you mean by normal.
Think about that. Long after a vaccine should be available, it could still be possible Americans are still spreading the virus and dying from it. And when you look around the world, you continue to see flare-ups and outbreaks that are really instructive just to show how quickly everything can devolve again. In fact, right now, Europe is home to some of the biggest outbreaks on Earth, and ABC's James Longman is right there in the newest epicenter. Where are you, James?
I am in Brussels. I'm about an hour away from Liège, which is a town which they think could be the worst affected place on Earth.
Did people just stop caring? I thought Europe was looking so good. What happened here?
Yeah, I think like many parts of the rest of the world, at the end of the summer, infection rates were down. Countries very keen to get their economies back on track. But this virus came back with a vengeance. And every country in Europe is now saying the second wave is much worse than the first. And they use that word much. And I was really shocked, actually. On the train over to Belgium, I was reading the stats here. Belgium currently has a 21% infection rate. That's for every time they run a test, 21% of people are coming out positive. And shockingly, in Liège, which is about an hour away from where I am now, it is at 41%.
Wow.
Possibly the worst affected place on the planet right now.
We are in full emergency. Our health personnel, nurses and physicians
are working round the clock.
I spoke to you, Brad, from Bergamo in Italy over the summer, which was the epicenter of the outbreak in Europe. In Italy, we saw all those horrid pictures of people dying in the hospitals. Liège looks like it's going to become that place again. And very, very shockingly, 10 hospitals in that town are saying they have no choice but to use doctors who have already tested positive and still are testing positive for the coronavirus, but are asymptomatic, because if they don't put them on shift, the health system will collapse. Oh, God. This is how serious it is in Belgium at the moment.
Après avoir consulté les scientifiques, dialogué avec les forces politiques, économiques et sociales.
And it's a similar picture across Europe, although not as awful yet, but that is the concern. So that's why President Macron in France has just announced a new lockdown there. It starts Friday and it'll run until the end of November. Everything is closed once again, just like the summer. Only exceptions to that rule are schools and factories will continue. So it's a slightly lighter lockdown. Same situation in Germany, but they are spooked. And I think it's Belgium that's spooking people here. And a lot of people, and I have to say, Brad, me included, for a long time, were saying, well, there are a lot of cases, but where are the deaths? Well, the deaths are up too. And that is the big concern.
And so that makes me wonder then how equipped any of us, America, other countries, how equipped we are to deal with more of this, or even another virus in the future. And James, along with National Geographic, you've embarked on this documentary sort of asking scientists what they are worried about in the near and long term.
Yeah, it's been fascinating, Brad. We've been all around the world. Went to Turkey, went to Liberia, and I was over there in the United States as well, trying to work out where the next pandemic might come from.
So this is it. We've just got to Liberia.
And the situation is that in countries around the world, viruses are fighting to jump from animals to humans.
So you and your team are going inside a cave where Ebola was found. Is Ebola still in there? Is it still out here?
I mean, probably.
We've seen that now with coronavirus linked to a bat in China. And so what we did is we went to places where there are large communities of bats. We went to bat caves in Liberia.
Masks on?
Yep.
Masks on.
To discover just why it is that bats are such a great vector for disease and how it is that they are spreading diseases in this way. I think they get demonized, but the issue is that humans are spending far too much time in the vicinity of these sorts of animals and abusing the natural world fundamentally.
Whoa. Wow. So there's an entire colony in here.
Yeah.
We went into one disused mine shaft in Liberia where we found a whole colony of bats.
Oh, wow.
Oh, my God.
And in the corner of this mine shaft,
you can see this, the younger one.
We found a whole series of younger bats that had died of some kind of virus.
And I think, obviously, the issue is if there's a poacher in here and there's a dead bat and there's blood or whatever, right? So that's a problem. So there's probably some sort of disease, exactly.
I can tell you, it was a pretty spooky place for me to find myself in, Brad. I was with a professor of public health from Harvard University who spent his life making this link between public health and the natural world.
We have a vineyard with grapes. Bats could be flying out of the cave, defecating on the grapes. Humans eat the grapes. A virus is transmitted. You have an olive tree. They could take a tiny bite of the olive. Human eats the rest of the olive, a transmission event could occur.
And the bottom line basically is we've got to make sure that we're not trespassing basically into the territories of all these kinds of wildlife.
So the viruses being present in animals is nothing new. It's just that we're spending more time encroaching into their turf. So obviously we're going to come in more contact with them. And that means what? We're not doing ourselves any favors in preventing future outbreaks.
Absolutely not. And you know, and it's not just some foreign experience which happens in these kind of far off places.
Oh, we got one in there.
We do.
Oh,
there's one in there.
Yep.
We came to the United States because the relationship with wildlife in the United States is a complicated one.
So the idea then is a hunter kills a deer, takes the head off, and puts it in one of these boxes.
Yeah, this is a self-sample kiosk. We've got a number of these located throughout the community.
I found myself in the Midwest in Wisconsin, where 400,000 deer are killed for hunting every year.
We eat a ton of venison so as a whole family.
But CWD, chronic wasting disease, it's a major illness, and it's spread to about half of the states in the United States.
There's no cure for it. There's no treatment for it. It basically turns the brain into a sponge.
It's an illness that kills any deer that gets it. It's not yet jumped to humans, but it could. And so these dangers are there in the United States.
And the ways in which people are harvesting wild animals, there could be
some sort of spillover.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's something that's certainly on people's mind. You know, what if? You know, that's something that is just a mutation away.
The message is, the greater the demand for meat and dairy products, it's quite simple, the greater the risk. To Americans, to Liberians, to people living in Turkey, in China, here in Belgium, anywhere in the world.
Yeah, that airs Sunday night on National Geographic, and it's enough to just make you, like, bury your face in your palms because you wonder, instead of these pandemics happening every 100 years, what if this happened a lot more often? What do we need to do to make sure that this isn't just a cycle we're embarking on? James Longman in Brussels. Great reporting, and please stay safe.
Thank you, Brad. Thanks a lot.
And one last thing. Quick, how many letters are in the Greek alphabet? Because last night, yet another hurricane rumbled onto American shores. This one is Hurricane Zeta.
The eye wall of Hurricane Zeta right now is cutting into New Orleans.
Powerful wind gusts are really the concern here. They are worried that this could knock out power for hundreds of thousands and do some real damage before it moves northeast.
Now remember, it sounds like a Z, but Zeta is only the sixth letter in the Greek alphabet. You'd have another 18 to go before Omega, in which case you'd have to find a whole new system for names. But we've never seen anything like this. The continental U.S. has not had a storm this strong this late in the season in more than a century. And while the number of storms is an international concern, Louisiana has had the worst of it. This is now the fifth named storm this year, a state record.
No one should be complacent because it's late October.
In the meantime, hurricane season is officially supposed to end November 30th, but with warmer waters around the world and only so many letters left, no one's quite sure how far this big, scary set of names could go. Pretty cool, 2020. You are quite a year. Our thoughts with the people in Louisiana and surrounding areas this morning. More on all these stories at abcnews.com or the ABC News app. I'm Brad Milkey. See you tomorrow.